Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's Word of Mom Radio. I'm your host, Bree DiCarlo, and you know we are here week after week breaking those myths that mompreneurs just, you know, dabble in business. And right now I am, those of you know, I've been on the road, I've been in Florida. I'm actually sitting in the parking lot of the Twin Rocks Diner in somewhere in Pennsylvania off of 84. And thankfully, Renee, our host of Renee Live on Sunday nights at 9 p.m., is in the studio. So if anybody calls in or if anybody's in the chat room, you'll be chatting with Renee today. And it's just the joys of being a mompreneur. And, of course, me with my kids grown and gone, I'm just kind of out doing things for other people now. So I'm very excited about today's guest, who I had the pleasure of meeting at the National Publicity Summit. And her name is Dr. Cardi Raper. And let me give you a little background on Cardi. She's extensively published in national and international scientific journals. She's also authored several book chapters. She received a master's in science degree from the University of Chicago and a PhD from Harvard. She was awarded over 20 grants for her research from the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and the United States. I'm off the host cue, it just said. I don't understand what that means. Hopefully you guys can hear me. And I'm hoping that you can. Cardi, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. Then we are recording. The remarkable thing to me about Cardi is, Cardi, when did you start in science? What year
did
you begin?
What do you mean by start? My interest started way back when I was 8 years old in third grade.
And what year was that?
I was born in 1925, so what, eight beyond that? 33, 32.
That, to me, is what is so remarkable, is that, you know, in 1933, I have had the pleasure of reading Cardi's book, which will be coming out next week, A Woman in Science, An Extraordinary Journey of Love, Discovery, and the Sex Life of Mushrooms, which, you know, never occurred to me, and I guess not being a scientist, it wouldn't occur to most people that mushrooms have sex lives, you know? You know, again, it is such an interesting book to read your journey, because let's face it, in the 1930s and 40s, when you were in school and interested in science, women were home. Women were not in science classes and things like that. And before we get into, you know, where you are now and what you're doing, I really want you to share with our listeners what that was like for you. You know, because today's scientists are, you know, the women that are in the lab now, you're one of those people that paved that way.
Yes, I was born the youngest in a family of six and the only girl. However, my parents did value education, but I do recall when I came home one evening for supper, we sat around the family dinner table, and I had just been so excited by the teachings of a science teacher who came to our grade or class every week or so and got me all wound up about science, teaching about volcanoes and the universe and all those things. I announced to my parents, well, when I grow up and when my brother grows up, we want to be scientists. And my mom said, well, that's nice, dear. Jonathan can be a doctor and you can be a nurse. So that was her expectation of what a scientist would be. In those days, a girl might grow up, well, a girl was expected to grow up and get married and have children. But, you know, failing that, she was, she could be a secretary or she could be a nurse or she could be a teacher in elementary school. That was about it.
And then along comes you. And you know what? Let's face it. As you were doing this, as you were in school, I'm sure in the back of your mind you weren't thinking, oh, I'm paving my way for the other women who come behind me.
Oh,
you
no.
know, you were just, right, exactly. You were just fulfilling your dreams. And, you know, again, it's such an interesting book. And I would love for you to give us just a little taste of the journey that you went through, because it's such a remarkable journey. It really, really is.
Well, I would start with being the youngest and only girl of this large family. My brothers were tough. They gave me tough love. They were always testing me. They were trying to rule the roost and say, you know, we're boys, we can do anything, and if you want to join us, go ahead. But, you know, we're testing you. And I would play football with them, and they would always have me be the center, shooting the football off to the, you know, the backstop or whoever they were called, the quarterback, and then push my face in the mud and go, you know, make the goal. Or they'd toss me in a blanket, or we would cross a stream, and they'd put a rope across the stream, and I was supposed to go across hand over foot, and then they'd swing the rope in the middle of the stream until I giggled so much I almost fell off the rope, but then they knew when to stop. And often they would say, if I really accomplished something that they thought was pretty darn good, they'd say, that's pretty good for a girl. So that was the way I was brought up.
You know, I can so totally commit. I had three brothers, and, you know, they used to tie me up and lock me in the closet.
Oh, no.
Yeah, oh, yeah, my older brother would hold me down and, like, you know, spit in my mouth and stuff.
Oh, no, they didn't do that to me.
But I can, you know, it's amazing because, you know, I was the quarterback on our touch football team because I had the best arm.
Oh,
and my brothers were faster than me, but I had a really strong arm. Again, because that's like learning how to shoot when I was on the farm. You know, my brother was like, okay, I'm going to put this rock on that cannon. If you miss it, I'm going to beat you up. So I missed the first time. I never missed after that because I got beat up. So it was like, hey, my eye got really good, really quick.
So you empathize.
Yeah, I can totally relate to this. On the flip, you know, now my brother's, you know, my youngest brother just turned 50 a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, well, it's the first time that all of us are in the same decade in 8 years, because our oldest brother's 8 years older than me. And then I'm 52 and I have 51 and 50. And I'm like, happy 50th birthday. He's like, oh my God. He's like, I can't even think about it. I'm like, trust me, 50s are awesome. You know? But it is, it's just, it's amazing because my brothers, it's so funny, even now, it's the three of them and me.
Well,
you know,
I'll tell you, the 80s are awesome as well for me.
You know what? I'm looking forward to them because you seem to be rocking them like crazy.
I am. I just came home from mentoring a little girl up the street at the school up the street. I live in a neighborhood full of immigrant children, and she comes from Thailand. I've been trying to help her read, and today was the last day with her. Then she moves on to middle school next year. But she wrote a card. She did a card for me, which was a lovely embellished card with jewels and colors and figures on it. And it said, "You're the best. Cardi, you rock."
Aww. You know, see, but you know what? You do rock. And it's amazing to me, you know, in reading your you know, little bit of credentials from the book, you know, and you talk about your PhD from Harvard. Your PhD from Harvard happened after your husband died, after you had kids, and, you know, pushing to stay in the lab and knowing that until you got those credentials, even though you had all the experience, all of the understanding, you know, everything you needed without that, you know, it's that old commercial, you ain't going nowhere without that sheepskin boy, you know, without that PhD behind your name. You know, so I mean, and it is, it's an inspiring thing to me and to especially other women. Not that men can't be inspired by your story, but for women to see what you have accomplished, you know, at a time where women weren't in the lab at all, except as a nurse, like you said, or where you now get a PhD, like I said. I mean, how old were you when you began your dissertation and your doctoral?
I was 52 years old when I got it, but I got it pretty quickly because I had already been working in my husband's lab, and he was running the lab. Of course, he had all the credentials, and I was the one who was doing the bench work and dealing with the students and the visiting professors and so forth. So I was in the thick of it when he died, and I'd already published quite a bit. So by the time I went for the graduate degree, it only took me about a year, and which was very nice because I didn't really want to spend much longer. And I did still have things to learn. I always have things to learn. But I got that degree and had a postdoc over in the Netherlands. And then it took me quite a while to launch into the age of molecular biology and molecular genetics. And that was really necessary to carry on what my husband and I had started with Mendelian genetics before he died.
You know, it's amazing because even now, why does that leaky pipeline still persist for women in science?
I think that's a good question, and part of it is, I think, biology. Part of it is that we're just different from men. We're the ones who, you know, we're the ones who nurture the children before they're even born. It takes energy and time to do that, and I think by nature, women tend to be a little more nurturing than men, just naturally, and that we really want to stay home or at least pay attention to those little babies that we born that we bore, and be a principal parent for them. I think that's one reason. But the other is that men are still, you know, feel that they are dominating in certain fields, not so much in biology anymore, but even in biology, we find that women assume so many responsibilities in the home as parents that they just can't keep up. If you don't publish as many papers as the guys do, you're behind. And once you're behind, you're behind. And you're judged on your productive ability in the field of science. You're not judged on other attributes such as being a parent of several children.
Right.
So that's part of the reason, I think, that we just naturally want to be there for our kids and our grandkids. That's part of the reason for the leaky pipeline. But I think there also is definitely a prejudice in many fields, particularly in engineering, in mathematics, in, look at the industry, CEOs and that sort of thing. No question.
You know, it's amazing because it's still that oh boy network, which is why I love Word of Mom Radio, because we're here empowering women. And let's face it, we were taught, especially you were taught, you know, you had to make that choice. You had to be a wife and a mom, or you can be in science. And you got to be both.
Yeah, I did. But I don't think people could follow, I don't think many women could follow my pathway anymore, because the whole field has become so incredibly competitive. I think all industry in the United States has become more and more competitive, but science in particular. You really have to produce, and if you aren't competitive, the other guys get ahead of you. And often it was, well, in the old days, you know, the women who did make it never married and didn't have children. They were what we called in those days old maids.
Well, and you know what? And again, and then there's you.
Yep.
You know, who's raised two children and is a grandma, and, you know, hopefully will be a great grandma, you know. And I told you this before we did the show. I mean, you just remind me so much of my grandmother, and I mean that. She was one of my all-time favorite people. You know, I lost my mom and I lost my grandmother and then my mom in less than a year. So, like, my two favorite women who, you know, I mean, my grandmother left my grandfather in the 50s, took her two kids, moved to Florida, came back, you know, worked three jobs, came back and opened a nightclub.
And, you know, so I can't imagine doing that.
I know, but when my older brother got married, I walk in the door and she's like, "When are you going to make me a great grandmother?" I'm like, "Hey, I'm not the one getting married today. You know, Stephen's the one who's getting married. Why don't you talk to him?" She's like, "So who needs a husband? You loved each other at the time." It was just, she was just, my brother got married. They were like, "I now pronounce you man and wife. You may kiss the bride." My grandmother slaps her hand on the table. She's like, "You got 1 year. And then I want to know why I'm not a great grandmother." And you know what? Bless her heart. When my grandmother died, she had 7 great-grandchildren.
Wow. Well, I don't think I'd do that to my grandson. He's coming up actually tomorrow. Actually, tonight he's coming up to visit. And he's got a girlfriend, and they're not married. And I'm sure they're together and, you know, a permanent couple. But I'm not going to hound him. I don't think it's proper to hound him.
Well, you know, it isn't proper. But, you know, my grandmother being an Italian grandmother, you know, everyone she knew had great-grandchildren up the wazoo. And she's you know, what is taking you people so long? You
know? They're being responsible.
Well, absolutely. You know, I look at my kids. My kids are all grown. And it's like, I can't wait to be a grandmother, but I can wait.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, they're 25, 23. My daughter will be 21 in July. It's like, guys, just take your time. And, you know, I'm ready when you are. You know, I'm not going to push it, but, boy, I can't wait.
But you know what? I'm concerned that there are too many people in the world to begin with. When I just heard somebody talk. His name was, what was his last name, his famous name? Anyway, he was a doomsayer. He was a population geneticist or population studies person, and he said that the Earth cannot sustain more than 2 billion people, and that's about as many as there were when I was born. There are 7 billion now, so
right.
We must be responsible.
See, now that's my daughter. My daughter, who is like, you know what, Mom? She was like, you show. I was the house that, like, the brought kids to keep them out of foster care. And I took my girlfriend's son, who was 14 months old at the time. I was supposed to take him for 2 weeks. I actually took leadership of him for a year and a half to keep him out of foster care. And my daughter was like, Mom, you showed me that you didn't have to give birth to Jared to love him like he was yours.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, when he went home to his mom, you gave up your son and my little brother. So my daughter feels that way. She was like, you know, there's so many people. I think I'm just going to wind up adopting kids. And I'm like, that's fine. I said, you know what? Whatever choice you make works for me.
Yeah.
You know, it just does, because we do have to be responsible and everything else. And, you know, in your field of study, in that field of study of mushrooms, you know, and the whole pheromone aspect of it and what the fungi teaches about, you know, what we see, the way we smell, how we taste. I mean, explain all of that, because, again, I'm not somebody, science was always very foreign to me because I'm dyslexic and everything else. And so in reading your book, you know, it's like, okay, well, I have to read your book because I'm going to have you on the show. I couldn't put your book down because it was so interesting to me.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. I worked very hard on that book. It took me many, many years to learn how to write about my science so that non-scientists could understand at least some of it and how the science is done, yes, and why I was so passionate about being a scientist. I love being a scientist. I love being a mother, too, but I really love being a scientist because it's like a lifelong detective story where
right.
You ask questions that nobody has ever known the answer to. And you go to the laboratory and you try to figure out how can I answer this question? What kind of an experiment can I set up that will give me some information about it? And the thrill of getting that information, being the first one in the world to discover something, is just beyond description. So that has always caught me. And I got into the fungi because when I went to the University of Chicago and met and I decided to go on to graduate school, I met a professor named John Raper. He wanted to be called Red, and he loved the fungi, and he taught me to love the fungi. They are such a fascinating group of organisms. They have so many different lifestyles, and among those lifestyles is the many different ways in which they reproduce sexually. And the genes that are involved and the molecules that are involved and how that relates to all the other organisms in the animal kingdom and as well as humans. So we kept, you know, at it for about 50 years, some of the first part of it with my husband. And the last part after he died, I went on my own and set up my own lab, worked with my own associates, and we did discover that pheromones and pheromone receptors are involved. They're very important. They're found throughout the animal kingdom, including humans. And they're used, the receptors for these pheromones are used for in humans to see and to smell and to taste. Well, at least similar ones. So in the mushroom fungus, we can use that fungus to study those in a way that you can't do with human beings. You can figure out, you know, what fits with what and how and why.
You know, again, it's just so interesting to me. And I remember, it goes all the way back to the publicity summit when you and I met and you were talking to me about your book and the whole, you know, and we started talking about pheromones and you know, finding your soulmate and how it could be linked, you know, through mushrooms and things like that. And it's just like, really? You know, you're, again, not being a scientist, I'm like, okay, uh-huh. Yeah, all right, this will be interesting to see. And then in reading the book, you really did do a wonderful job in creating a story that is very, has a lot of scientific information and time in your lab and everything else with somebody like me who is not, that is not my forte, could feel completely comfortable with it and feel like, okay, I actually understand what she's talking about here, which just goes to show what a really good teacher you must be.
Well, I'm quite good one-on-one. I'm not the best lecturer in the world, but you know, I love teaching. I love teaching at all levels, and I love to get people excited about things I'm excited about. And I think, you know, I think my mission in my old age now is to try to acquaint non-scientists with the value of science, why it's important, to understand the discipline of this field and the way of thinking and how you get information and how, you know, it's never the absolute truth, but it's approaching the truth. It's a way of thinking and a way of discovery that I think people, not too many people, really understand, particularly our Congress. Our legislator.
Oh, gee, there's a whole other show.
We shouldn't go there, but
oh, trust me, we can go, you know what, we can go wherever you want. This is actually your conversation, so, you know, believe me, I mean, it's funny, the older I become, the more and more of a libertarian I become.
Is that right? Well,
yes, because it's yeah. Just, our government wasn't designed to be in our business the way it is.
Well, there are many faults to its design, that's pretty clear, but we have to live with it, and we have to do the best we can. And I guess my only little part that I can play is to try to, you know, impart some knowledge that might be useful. That's all.
What, understanding. For you, when somebody reads your book, oh, Cardi, you know what, as people are listening, those of you just tuning in, we're here on Word of Mom Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Cardi Raper about her book, A Woman of Science, An Extraordinary Journey of Love, Discovery, and the Sex Life of Mushrooms, which is coming out next week. How can people find your book?
Aha. They can go to my website, and it's all there, including the reviews and other information about it and how to order it. The website is simply Cardi Raper, CardiRaper.com. You know, prefaced by www, so it's www.cardiraper.com.
So you mentioned, you know, Red Raper, who wound up being your husband, but you right. were his student.
I was. And I just sent a little, I just got an email yesterday from the University of Chicago magazine saying, you're an alum, and we'd be interested if you could tell us we want to have a section called True Confession. What did you do that was wrong or bad or you felt guilty about when you were a student? Well, guess what I wrote? You can guess what I wrote, right?
Yeah, I can. And you know what? For those of you who want to know what she wrote, read the book.
It was scandalous.
You know, but it really was. I'm serious. That's why I'm serious. I so applaud you. I truly do, because you know what? It was scandalous.
Yes.
It was completely scandalous and completely shocking. And that's why, another reason I love your book. And I love the pictures in your book. And I love the picture of you in your little dinghy. With that smile
that's
on your face.
Story, yes.
I was so funny when before I read the little paragraph on it, I'm looking at that picture going, she's in there naked. I love her.
How did you know that? It doesn't show all.
You can't know. You know what? You don't see anything. But I was like, I know a naked body when I see one. And I'm serious. The more I read your book, the more I just fell in love with the woman that you are. And just because you've always been yourself. And there's really no apology to who you are.
Well, I think it's the way I was brought up. You know what? I think it's all luck, Dori. I was just very lucky to have been born at the time I was, of the parents who bore me, within the family I had, and the place I was born. I just was lucky. And I've got good genes, by and large, and I was brought up pretty correctly and to care for other people as well as myself. And here I am. I'm a lucky 88-year-old woman who is still enjoying life. And I think
really
it comes
are.
From being myself, yes.
Well, you know what? And this is, again, what Word of Mom Radio is all about. And it's celebrating women and sharing the wisdom of women and applauding women that build their businesses from home or have found that balance between working out of the home and in the house raising children and everything else. And we're here to learn from each other, you know. And that's where I think mompreneurs and women who found that balance between building a business and raising a family or, you know, following their, you know, life's dreams and just women in business completely differ. Because we're here to support each other. We're here to teach each other. We're here to say, hey, I just figured out how to do this, this, and this, you know, and we share it. And for you as a scientist, I mean, those, you have to record step by step how you've done what you've done, how you've reached this conclusion, how you support that conclusion, and everything else. So you have laid such groundwork for the people who come after you that are now continuing on with what you and your husband started and everything else. And it's kind of remarkable to me because without, you know, the fungi, as you were talking about, what happens to our forests? What happens to our world without all of these organisms that we don't even think about?
We're all a part of it, and we all depend on one another, not just mothers and kids and husbands, but, you know, the whole ecosystem. We are destroying so many things right now that the consequences of which are pretty dire to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And just here's a good example, Dori. I had some problems with my digestive tract, and I almost died over that, but I got saved. And it turns out that what was really, really troubling me was an imbalance of all the little bacteria that live in my gut. Everybody has trillions of bacteria living in their gut that help with the way they deal with food and nutrition. And if it gets out of balance, it can destroy you. Well, that, you know, we think we're a single organism. We are not. We are very dependent on even little bacteria like that. And that's just one example.
Absolutely. You know, I was down in Florida, and, you know, our listeners know that I was down there actually helping out some friends of mine who were sick. And one of them had just come back from Mexico. While I was down there, she had gone away for a couple of weeks. You know, 4 days later, can't keep down food. For that, I dragged her to the hospital to find out that she had a bit of E. coli, and it, you know, created a tremendous bladder infection for her and
terrible
stuff. But
yeah,
her husband was like, thank God you were here, because he never could have got her to the hospital.
Uh-huh.
You would have just, you know, and the doctors told her, they were like, thank God you got here by now, because had you waited another day, you know, it's just, and people don't realize it. They don't realize the friendly bacteria that you have in your body. You know, it's like when you take an antibiotic. It's making sure that you're taking yogurt with, you know, the acidophilus in it, so the healthy bacteria in your body isn't killed by the antibiotic you're taking. And stuff.
Yes, we still need to know much, much more about it, but it is a very important subject. It's just an example of, you know, I studied fungi, but people who study bacteria are very important, and what they can produce or what they can find out is very helpful, not just to humans, but to the entire environment.
So I have to ask you, what, you know, I remember with my webmaster, she was learning things, and she would make a mistake, and actually her mistake would lead her to a shortcut that she didn't know she could do. What was your best mistake in the lab?
Oh, I made many mistakes. But that's the life of a scientist. You think you're going to do something and it fails, and then you just stick to it and try again. Gee, what was my worst one?
Your best one. Like the best mistake that you made, where you made a mistake, a quote-unquote mistake, that actually led you to what you were looking for. Do you ever have one of those mistakes?
Oh, dear. I would have to think about it. It doesn't come easily because we've all made many mistakes. Let me think. Yeah, one time I wrote up a proposal to the National Institutes of Health, and I and my postdoc were going to go after one of these mating-type genes that exists in a wood-rotting mushroom that we worked with. This wood-rotting mushroom, by the way, has 20,000 different sexes, and in part they're determined by many, many different pheromones and pheromone receptors that are encoded by many different genes. So I was going to try to, we were going to try and isolate the gene, one of those genes, just to find out what it was like, because we didn't know what they were encoding in those days. I gave the proposal before I sent it in to a colleague. He was furious because he thought that was his turf, that he was the one who was going to be the first to find out what a mating type gene encoded. I guess it was a mistake. Yes, it was a mistake to show it to him, because I didn't realize that he was not going to be helpful. He was just going to be mad and upset and furious with me because of the competitive business of trying to get grants. It's an example, you know. Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? And you know what? And again, as you were speaking about in the beginning, the competitive nature has only gotten, it's only gotten more competitive.
Yes.
And as the field, you know, science is expanding and everything else, I can only imagine how people close ranks within their own field.
Yes, you are quite right. And I guess by nature, humans are pretty competitive. They want to be the first and the best. And that pays off in our society. So That I defy. I think that was also my most courageous moment, that mistake, because I decided, look, I have just as much right to go after those genes as you do, and I'm going for them. And
yep.
They found one, and I found another. So, you know, together we found a whole bevy of genes that were involved in sexual reproduction in this mushroom. And if we'd done it together in a nice way, it would have been nicer.
Well, absolutely. And you know what? And again, when you know, because you talk about it in the book, when you came out with what you were writing, you weren't doing it as a competition.
No.
You know?
I was curious. I wanted to find out.
Exactly.
And I had a way to do that. But anyway, it's all complicated, but I think we all ended up better off for that. So,
well, you know, let's face it, things happen the way they happen, and maybe, you know, even just that little bit of that competition of, you know, so do I back down or not? Many people would have backed down.
Yes.
especially women.
Women tended to. Yes, you're right.
Exactly. You know, that you were going up against.
It bothers me today, Dori, that I still see women, and I saw them very frequently at Wellesley College, where I taught for several years, that the women coming in to as freshmen were very reticent to ask questions and be aggressive in any way. Assertive, I guess, is the term. And one of my greatest feelings of accomplishment when I taught at Wellesley was to see how many of these young women, very bright young women, ended up as juniors and seniors with a sense of self-worth and a sense of, you know, I can do it, and I can ask questions, and I can question authority, and I can go out there and do stuff. And by golly, they did. The gals who came into my lab, where I think I functioned best in tutoring or mentoring, all ended up in very good positions in science. And I was very pleased about that. I think I helped them. And I think, you know, a place like Wellesley does help reticent young women find themselves.
Absolutely. I don't know if you can hear the rain. It's pouring over here right now. It's so much fun being on the road.
Okay.
It really is.
We haven't gotten that rain yet. It's coming.
It really is. So, all right, wait, for those of you just tuning in, we're here on Word of Mom Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Cardi Raper, and you can find her book at www.cardyraper.com, and it really is a wonderful book. And today's shows, I just want to say hello to our sponsors today. We have Healthy Concepts, Renee Sullivan, who's here with us all the time. She's just a wonderful woman who, you know, is building her business and sharing healthy nutrients, healthy ways of eating, healthy ways of cleaning, you know, looking at what you use in your home and everything else and making sure that it's environmentally sound, environmentally friendly because it's your home, you know. And we all know that I'm a huge proponent of organics and, you know, not poisoning the environment you live in. So you can visit her at resully, resully.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Renee Health Nut. And you can go to our Word of Mom Radio website, so wordofmomradio.com/MMM, and you will meet all of our mompreneur-made and mompreneur-approved product and service providers. Thank you to Healthy Concepts. We're back here on Word of Mom Radio with Dr. Cardi Raper. So I have to ask, because you had mentioned this when we met. All right, so how is a mushroom going to actually help me find my soulmate? Because I've yet to find that person.
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but you find the people you like and want to be with through your senses, what they look like, what they smell like, what they taste like. And as well as, you know, what they say, what they think. And the senses are driven by molecules similar to those that the mushroom uses to find its mate. So
really?
That's where the, yes. However, that hasn't all been worked out with humans because humans are very much more complex than mushrooms. And they've bundled these sensory molecules all together in different organelles and so forth, and it's very hard to separate what's doing what. But they do know something about the molecules. We do know there is a good study that has said that rats find their mates using pheromones, and these receptors, they're called. In fact, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to some biochemists last fall who discovered these particular kinds of receptors. They're called GPCRs. You don't have to know what all that stands for, but that's what they're scientifically called. They're receptor molecules that thread in and out of the membrane, and they transmit signals from outside the cell to inside the cell. They're very, very important throughout the animal kingdom in sensing your environment. And so that's about as close as I can come to try to explain why the mushroom what was the term? How you find your soul? Why is it similar to how you find your soulmate? Well, we don't know exactly yet, but there's a hint of it that these same molecules are involved in our trying to find our soulmates, and it hasn't been absolutely proven yet. And that's one of the things you have to understand about science, that most of the information out there is not absolute truth.
Right.
People who don't believe in, you know, the Darwinian concept of evolution say, oh, it hasn't been proven. Well, of course, every little bit of it hasn't been proven. But, boy, the evidence is pretty overwhelming.
Right.
So that's the way it goes. We'll never understand it all.
See, but it's interesting because, again, two people can read the same thing.
Yes.
And for one, it's, okay, you know, the evidence is overwhelming here. And for that other person, it's like, well, but you can't prove this to me.
Yeah. And, you know, we can't prove everything that we that we think about. I mean, they're not subject to proof. So I guess we have to be content with not knowing everything we'd love to know. And that's my view, that, you know, I just keep trying to find out more and more, but I'm content that I don't know everything. That's the way it is.
If you could go back to, you know, something where you were saying how, you know, you weren't able to find out something, or you weren't able to find that conclusive evidence for you, is there one time where you could go back and say, you know, boy, I wish I could have worked on this a little longer?
Oh, sure. I mean, when I ended my career, I actually officially retired from the University of Vermont as a research professor in 1994. Now, that's quite a while ago. But I stayed there and still, you know, got grants and ran a lab and even did some experiments until 2004, so 10 years later. And when I stopped doing that, I decided to write about it. There were so many things I didn't know and I wished I could go on and find out about in my own field. I would like to know, you know, just what, when these pheromones and receptors, and there's some other molecules involved that we know about, trigger a whole cascade of events that lead to making babies, essentially. I'd like to know what is in that cascade of events. You know, what genes are involved, what molecules are they encoding, how do they function? But can't live long enough to do that.
You know, it's amazing because with all of the questions you answered, there's so many more still unanswered.
Absolutely. That's what's the way science goes. You get one answer to one question, it just opens up a dozen more.
I was just going to say, so you find the answer to one, and, you know, another 20 pop up.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, it's because nothing is absolute. I mean,
that's,
I remember
right,
when I was in school studying psychology, and one of the first things our professor said was, there are no absolutes in psychology because two people can experience the exact same event, the exact event, but they're going to perceive it differently. It's going to impact them differently. You know, one person who may be schizophrenic and another person may be this, but they're presenting this. But what was really interesting to me is we got into homosexual and all of a sudden he started saying these absolutes. All homosexuals are this. I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, how in the world can you say, you start out saying that, you know, there are no absolutes in psychology. How in the world can you just say all homosexuals are this and that and that and this?
Well, you know, that's a field that my son, Jonathan, has gone into. He studies how the nervous system develops and what molecules and genes are involved in simply the development of the nervous system and the brain, and how the brain is wired and how it can be wired differently for, you know, in different circumstances. So he's gone on to something even much more complex than his parents studied. That was his way, and he's still at it. But the other thing that comes to mind when you mention that, Dori, is that everything is changing all the time. Everything is changing. All the molecules are moving and changing. we're changing. Everything around us is changing. The whole environment is changing. So, you know, you can catch it at one stop point or another, but it doesn't tell you the whole story because it's always moving.
Right. But that's what makes it exciting.
Exactly.
Is that it is a never-ending story.
Uh-huh. It's exciting and worth living. Makes life worth living to be curious about all that.
So even though you've quote-unquote retired, when you look at what's happening in the field that you've studied now, what are the exciting, you know, I mean, we've talked about the pheromones, but, like, do you see people that are really exciting to you in your field now?
Yes. You know, the big, big thing that has developed since I retired is genomics, being able to just see what the whole genome of an organism looks like and compare it within phylum and outside of species and all that sort of thing, and try to make sense of that. It's a very, very complex science now that I try to understand. Another thing, Dori, is that I've always been fascinated with genetics, and that was my focus. You know, when I was in my first job as early 20s, we didn't even know what the molecule of inheritance was. We didn't know whether it was proteins or RNA or DNA. Well, it turned out to be DNA. But then it turns out now that RNA, which is translated from DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid, which makes up, you know, all our genes, it goes into RNA, nucleic acid. The RNA system preceded the DNA system, and it apparently has a tremendous function in regulating the way the DNA operates, how those genes function. That is a field I'd love to get my hands into, my brain into. There's so much to learn, and it was so complicated and it's so interesting what, you know, the effect of environment is on our innate being. And I'm particularly interested in the genetics of it.
Well, you know, and it must be so fascinating. And as I'm listening to you talk, I'm imagining what it was like to be in a lab in the late 30s, early 40s, as opposed to being in a lab in a new century.
Oh, very different. Actually, in a way, I kind of miss those old days because...
The hands-on, the everything that you mean, every single thing you did had to be recorded. Everything had to be regulated, the temperatures and everything. And it was all on you to make sure that it was done, as opposed to now where you go to that computer screen... When my girlfriend and I went to the hospital, we get into the emergency room. There was a kiosk for her to register at the. I was. This is just the saddest thing I've ever seen. That we're in the ER, and you know, what are your presenting problems? You know, shortness of breath. Da 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 da. I was like, you know, she hit other, and the nurse was like, why did you put other? I said, because you didn't have puking your guts up for 4 days. As an option.
Oh, dear.
I was like, the emergency room, and we're checking in at a kiosk.
Oh.
You know, yeah. So I can definitely see, you know, in the way things have evolved, where some of the evolution is just remarkable what can be done now. But, yeah, that hands-on,
mm-hmm.
You have
to miss
that.
Yeah, in the old days, a scientist could make a discovery all by him or herself. Mostly it was himself.
Mm-hmm.
A single person can make a very significant discovery. Nowadays, it's much more a group effort. There are many more mechanics about it. The way you do, I think, as I mentioned in my book, when I transitioned from just doing plain old genetics by breeding and looking at the offspring to molecular genetics, it was like switching cooking from, you know, cooking by your gut instinct. I like to cook just, you know, I'll put a little bit of this in, a little bit of that in,
mm-hmm.
See if this works, how does it taste. Well, with molecular genetics, you can't do it that way. You have to follow a recipe, and you damn well better follow that recipe, or you might, you'll come up with a crazy result.
Right.
That you don't want.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was, when the part in your book where you were editing one of the chapters you were writing,
yeah,
on whatever, I forget what publication it was, and it was now at the computer. And you
uh-huh.
saved it on the card because back when computers were
those,
you
know. Oh, that was,
you know,
a grant proposal, yeah.
Thank you. That's what it was. But it was,
yeah.
You know what, can totally relate to working on this proposal for somebody, and all of a sudden it disappeared. And I let out this groan, and my 8-year-old comes in, and he's like, Mommy, what's the matter? I was like, I don't know. It was on the computer. It disappeared. He's like, oh, here, Mom. Click, 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 boom, boom. Here it is.
Yes, I think
like,
that's wonderful.
I missed my paper and pencil.
But, you know, speaking of parenthood versus the children you're rearing, they're teaching us something now that they weren't able to teach us before. So we, you know, it's a two-way street, much more of a two-way street with our little kids, because they know so much more than we do about those, the mechanics of computers and all that sort of thing, which we all depend on.
You know, it is funny, and it's, you know, for me, of course, doing Word of Mom Radio, we've done shows about, you know, the internet and your children and things like that. I mean, my kids are 25, 23, and my daughter will be 21, so my two boys are, you know, they're all three on their own, you know, who's in college, who's doing this, who's doing that. Two out of my three kids don't even have a television and stuff like that. So I'm really happy that... My kids,
I even use a telephone book and get kidded for it.
You know what? See, I'm right there with you. Right there with you. And it's so funny because even though, you know, okay, I have an internet radio show and I have this online presence, nothing makes me happier than picking up the phone and calling somebody. Or while I was down in Florida, one of my friends on Facebook, we were able to get together and meet for a cup of tea because she was in the area and stuff like that. So I am much happier the one-on-one, and even with the advent of, I'm right. I can totally understand how, in on the one hand, at what we can do, but on the other hand, look at what we've lost. It's like kids working on calculators in school,
uh-huh.
you know. And I argue about it all the time because I'm like, look, they have to understand the fundamentals. Before you give them a scientific calculator, if they don't understand the basics of math, so great. They'll never be able to do anything in their life if they don't have a calculator with them.
You remember the days of the slide rule?
I do.
That didn't last
I remember
long.
My abacus. I had my abacus.
Yeah, an abacus.
You know?
Oh, that's really ancient.
And a compass and stuff like that, you know, where you actually looked at things and you had to do the circumference of things and stuff like that, as opposed to, you know, popping in your data and having it print out for you.
Well,
you know?
it's what it is, and it's fascinating.
You know, it is because with all of the strides and everything else that we are coming out with, you know, we gain, there's things you gain, there's things you lose.
Yep.
You know, and again, you know, I'm glad for my kids that childhood for them was still a journey. It didn't have to be a race,
mm-hmm.
you know.
That's a good way of putting it.
I hope for them they impart those things. You know, we had one television in the house, and so when we watched TV together, we all watched TV. We picked something as a family, and TV had to be appropriate for the youngest person in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we were watching. And I remember my son, Sesame Street was on with my daughter, and he's like, really, Mom, Sesame Street? I'm like, hey, Courtney's 3.5. Next thing you know, there's my son Danny sitting there with his sister singing I'll Stay on the Floor, you know, and he was like, wow, I forgot how much fun Sesame Street is, Mom.
Yeah. Well, speaking of
and it was so funny because he was only 8.
Yeah.
But still, you know, the let's face it, 4 years difference, you know, as you get older is nothing. 4 years difference when your siblings at, you know, birth to 4, 4 to 8, that's a big difference. You know,
but
now that they're all in their 20s,
yeah.
Not that big of a difference.
There's a big,
you know?
There's sort of an irony, you know, though, in what you were just saying, because I have a summer place that I bought up in the islands 27 years ago, and the family has always come up. From the time their kids were tiny, And we never had television. That was one of the rules. You don't have television at camp. You read, you play games, you go sailing, you go swimming, and so forth. Well, then everybody got laptop computers, and they bring them along. And now that the grandkids are grown up, we're all sitting around at night with those laptop computers on our laps, not talking to each other. Isn't that awful?
To me it is. It's so funny that you say that. I was out to dinner with friends of mine and looked over at the next table, and there was this whole family and one kid sitting there with their iPod, just completely disengaged from the family and doing what they were doing. And, again, that's why I'm saying, you know, two out of my three kids don't even have a television in their house. You know, who does that? They still – now, my boys love to read. I got them Kindle. They wanted the Kindle. My daughter is an avid reader like I am. We like the book. I want that book in my hand. I like to turn pages.
Yeah, I like
And that. I get teased about it all the time. You know?
Well, do what you want to do, I think.
But that's the whole thing. And that's why, you know, and your book truly is a page turner. It really is. It's a, you know what, Cardi, it's a really wonderful story that you talk and share very candidly the things that went on in your life.
Human, and they have interesting lives as well as anybody else. Right now, Dori, I'm writing another book, but it's about my husband's family. There were seven boys and one girl, all brought up on a poor tobacco farm in North Carolina, and they didn't have any plumbing or they didn't have any refrigeration or electricity in their home. It was a very, very hard life. The parents never went beyond seventh grade, but every one of those children went to college and beyond and became distinguished professionals. And I'm writing about them now, and I find, you know, having been brought up with the material handicaps that they were brought up with, how did they succeed? How did that happen? And they tell it in their own words. I find their words very interesting, the way they relate to one another. So that's what I'm into now. I'm trying to be go on with my author, my writing business. And
well, you know, when you finish that book, you'll have to send it to me and we'll have to share it. And you know what? God bless his parents.
Well, it was the father. The mother was Moravian, and she thought that keeping a fine farm was the goal that should be sought. But the father said, nope, this is no future. My children need to go on and learn things. And he valued education. It was just such a centering on the importance of education.
And you know, it's amazing. Did you ever read The Ditch Digger's Daughters?
I have not, no.
Oh, my God, what a fabulous book. And it's about an African-American family and, you know, this man who had five daughters. And education was everything. And he bought a piece of property in a good neighborhood, but couldn't get a loan to build a house because he wanted to get his kids into a good school.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and everything that he did and the way he, you know, was the first black man to get a loan from this certain bank. And 20 years later, his nephew was, or his grandson was the first black kid to get hired in that bank and things like that. And how one of his, you know, his daughters went on to be and who went on to be a this and a that, all because they were the ditch digger's daughters. And this man and his wife, she cleaned houses and stuff, and all they ever did was push education.
Uh-huh.
But they had to go to school, they had to go to school, they had to go to school. And so I can't wait to read the book that you're writing about Red's family.
Oh, I think it'll be interesting.
I think it will be, too. And we're getting ready to wrap up here. Cardi,
okay.
I'm so glad that we finally had a chance to share who you are and what you do. And, again, go to www.cardyraper.com, a woman of science, an extraordinary journey of love, discovery, and the sex life of mushrooms. It's really a wonderful book. It really, truly is. And I'm so glad that you were here with us today on Word of Mom Radio. I really am. Thank you so much. So is there anything, what do you want people when they read your book, give us our last thought of what do you want their takeaway to be when they read about what you've done?
Are you still there? Okay. Well, I just think they should try to, you know, appreciate the value of science and how it's done. That's my main message.
Well, rock on, because I think you again, paved the way without even knowing that you're paving the way. You were just following your dream.
Yes.
And look at the doors that you've opened and things that have happened because of the work that you started with your husband, continued on after his death, and what is now continuing on after you've retired. So, it's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, thank you
so much
for having me, Dori. I really have enjoyed this conversation with you.
It was a pleasure, and it was such a pleasure meeting you at the Publicity Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And I really look forward to when your next book comes out and reading about Red and his family, because it's going to be, I'm sure, a really, really interesting story.
I shall let you know when it's out.
I look forward to it. So, again, thanks so much for being here. And for those of you tuning in, Sunday night, Renee Live at 9 p.m. And then Tuesday, Janice Clark back in our business spotlight at 1 o'clock. So happy Memorial Day weekend to everybody. Be safe, be healthy. And for those of you tuning in after these, archives and weeks and months later, I hope you had a great Memorial weekend. So until next time, we will see you on Word of Mom Radio. Bye for now.